Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Vera Tobin. She's the assistant professor in the Department of Cognitive Sciences at Case Western Reserve University. And we're talking about her book, Elements of Surprise, Our Mental Limits and the Satisfaction of Plot. Vera, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you.
Great. Thanks for having me.
As we were talking off mic, there are books that I end up getting connected with that just surprise me because I always think, wow, I never would have even thought about doing research on this. And this is one of them. And I'm so glad you wrote this book.
Well, thank you. I'm glad I wrote it, too. I enjoyed myself.
I also want to mention for the benefit of the audience, we better do this right off, and you do it in the book clearly. Your book really gives off, it really does a lot of spoilers.
Yeah, it spoils things left, right, and center.
It's one big spoiler.
Yeah, I actually put a page on my website detailing all of the works, at least I think I caught everything, that are spoiled in the book. Categorized by like major spoilers and minor spoilers and so on because, yeah, sorry.
Luckily, I had read or seen everything that you mentioned in the book, so I that wasn't a problem. But I think this has got to be the first science book that I have interviewed, that I've covered, where that warning was at the beginning of the book.
Yeah, like spoiler alert is not a common feature of science books. It's true.
No, it's not. And so when you teach or you lecture, do you have to give out that warning too?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And then what also happens is, you know, often in some or all of the material that I'm working on in a class, especially in upper division seminars where we're working on some of this stuff, students will be going off on their own and collecting examples and presenting them. And then they spoil things for each other. It's a bloodbath, really.
Well, this book is about the cognitive aspects about why surprise endings in literature, in film, are so prevalent, and also why we feel so deeply about them. How did you come to this subject?
Well, you know, part of what was happening was that I was working in various ways on things to do with fiction and stories and film as a sort of source of exciting, wild data about how human beings think. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, we bring people into the lab and you have them do various kinds of tasks and you look at things under very controlled circumstances and this tells you something. But the things that we do spontaneously for each other in these kinds of ways provide a different kind of window onto the way we think. And I was just struck again and again by how often sort of the same structural tricks and scenarios came up and setting up surprises, and I knew that that was something I wanted to learn more about.
And why we enjoy them, and why we seem to get so much emotional bang out of the surprise endings.
Right, and you know, they're risky as well. So, you know, the thrill and satisfaction of a satisfying, well-constructed surprise comes from this whole arc of things being, you know, sort of making a certain kind of sense or incomplete sense or somewhat satisfying sense, but not completely. And then the surprise helps bring things into new focus and give them a new satisfying structure. And that is an experience that we enjoy in real life a lot, but we can't always come by it, you know, on demand, right? This thrill of discovery of having things make better sense. And so that's what surprises do for us.
And there's a great phrase that I learned in your book, and I love the name, a well-made surprise.
Yes.
And what is a well-made surprise?
Well, so, you know, I use the term by analogy to this formula for theater, the so-called well-made play that arose in 19th century French theater, where the idea was, you know, you can make play after play that follows a similar formula, you have the right ingredients, and people will find it fresh and exciting over and over again. And I said, well, you know, that's this idea that surprises can surprise you, by making fresh use of a relatively small but very productive toolkit of scenarios and tools and tricks that capitalize on the way that we think seemed analogous to me. And of course, they're also well made when they come off because they feel satisfying. They feel well constructed and solid in this way.
And you talk at end in the book about what would make a well-made surprise versus just throwing out a lot of crazy things one right after another. And this is a quote from your book. It should produce a flash reinterpretation of events together with the feeling that the evidence for the interpretation was there all along. And
right.
That really succinctly really describes what a well-made surprise is. You should feel like if I had only been paying attention in the right way, the evidence was right there in front of me.
Right. So that's what allows the surprise to feel like it's giving you insight into the way things make sense, because it fits together in a satisfying way. Of course, it's not the only kind of thing that can be pleasing in a fiction, but
right.
to work this way, it gives you that feeling, it fits together. Yeah.
And again, to reiterate, they're not merely unexpected, because that just could be anything, like Godzilla suddenly stepped on Tokyo, you know, and then everybody
right.
died. But they have to be a revelation. They have to be, the reader or the person watching the film has to feel like it's revelatory.
That's right. So it has to feel like it has to be a surprise reinterpretation of what you've already seen. Oh, it was something all along. Oh, these things that I've seen previously, I now have a fresh understanding of them.
Now, you talk about and describe that our brains conspire with stories to knit material together to produce an illusion of continuity. And that's how we are able to have a surprise.
That's right. And I mean, as you probably know, because you think about these things a fair amount, as we make our way through the world, we're continually in our sensory processing, in our understanding of causality, in our social cognition as we're making sense of the motivations of other people, sort of across all these different levels of our cognitive process of making sense of where we are and what we're doing and what's going on. What we actually have in terms of input is really fragmentary, partial, scattered in a variety of ways. And what our brains do in sensory processing and causal understanding in social cognition is to give us this feeling that they seamlessly fit together, that they're not just a scattered array of flashes of light and so on, but, a coherent picture. And stories can tap into that to do some magic tricks for you, a little sleight of hand.
Yeah, in the introduction to the book, you actually talk about Shakespeare's Othello as a way of illustrating these deceptions that a well-made surprise gives us. Talk about that.
Yes, well, so, I think Othello is really nice because as a sort of lens through which to see the ways in which we make sense of other people and the way that we make sense of stories, right? Because Othello, his downfall, right, is that Iago can tap into his own insecurities, but also his struggle to make sense of things around him
right.
in certain ways. And so, Iago seduces him into betraying himself. But in Othello, the way that this works is, Iago's the bad guy. And at the end, we condemn Iago. And, Othello feels that Iago was his enemy, right? A frenemy who turns out to truly be an enemy. But when fictions do this, what they need to do is they need to seduce you into deceiving yourself and
That's
then
right.
get you
right.
to come out feeling like everything's coming out roses, that the story wasn't betraying you, but instead was leading you through this pleasurable experience and so on.
What is the curse of knowledge? That's another great phrase I learned in this book.
I know, it's wonderful. So this term was coined originally by behavioral economists to describe sort of this one small corner of a set of this whole suite of tendencies that spring from a similar set of tendencies in the way that we think. So the curse of knowledge is, broadly speaking, once you know something or think you know something, and when especially when it's at the forefront of your attention, it will suffuse the kinds of inferences that you make about what it's like not to know it. You know, so if you know the answer to some riddle, it will, it's very difficult to, it's really impossible to put yourself into, to truly simulate what it's like not to know it. And so it will seem, tend to seem more obvious once you know the answer. There's all kinds of effects that arise from this. There's anchoring effects where once you're given a hint about something, it's very hard for you. You're just adjust away from that original proposal. Your own intentions tend to seem more transparent to you than they really are, and so on.
Does this also relate to the way we, if we're witnessing sudden events like a car accident, that we have a little bit of knowledge and we sort of then just write the rest of the story without even thinking about it?
Well, right. So there's sort of the counterpart to the curse of knowledge proper, where something that you're told outright or something that you know outright sort of seeps into your understanding of other stuff or your surmises about what other people will be able to figure out and so on, is this the tendency to produce illusions of knowledge. So you can see really gets you coming and going, right? Because you you fill things in, you make inferences based on prior experience, based on sort of various kinds of predictable tendencies that usually work pretty well, and you sort of when you forget things, you don't even notice necessarily that you've forgotten. So you fill the pieces in. So together, these things really can trip you up a whole lot. And of course, it's the case that in general, when we're sort of trying to fill in the pieces, we have to do this all the time. And so, of course, it makes sense when you're trying to think about what, for example, another person will be able to discern about a situation. The richest source of information that you have about what anybody might be able to figure out is your own perspective. So you start with what you've got and do your best, but it can trip you up.
As you write in the book, it can even make the unintelligible seem decodable in retrospect.
Right.
So you start writing, you know, reasons for stuff happening when it's not really there.
Right. We, but you know, once something is sort of presented to you as the answer, the solution, the consequence, the final step, you go back and you look for reasons why it makes sense. And things that fit with the consequence are much more readily accessible to you. You provide justifications in retrospect without even noticing that that's what you're doing.
Now, the authors, the film directors, the film, they're using this as a tool to create a specific effect in the audience.
That's right. So, you know,
and let me let's give out some films that you mentioned in the book. Like The Sixth Sense is a great example of a classic movie where there's a surprise at the end, and so the person who's directing and writing that, M. Night Shyamalan. Is literally using, he may not know it as the curse of knowledge or, but he's using that effect to lead you along and to create a specific effect.
That's right. So, you know, and The Sixth Sense is a great example for talking about this in a number of ways. One is the, as far as spoiler alerts go, I don't feel too guilty.
Because you think at this point in time, everybody's going to know he's dead.
Right.
He's dead.
Yeah, he's dead. He's dead. He was dead all along. He's a ghost. Yeah. And, you know.
Do you enjoy doing spoilers?
You know.
You said that with a little bit of glee.
Once I'm doing it, I do take a certain amount of
curse. Okay. Back to The Sixth Sense is a great example.
Right. So, you know, it makes use of these sort of predictable tendencies and the kinds of inferences that people will make really expertly and prominently. You know, it's not doing a subtle version of this. It's not just doing a little bit along the way. You know, sort of the whole structure of the movie stacks things so in order to produce this effect. Like, so much of what's in there is in there for the purpose of leading you down one road and then giving you the the reveal that sends you back looking over the events of the earlier parts of the film in this way. So, it gives you this viewpoint character who can see things that other people can't see, right? Which is an excuse for showing you things that other people can't see, but relies on the fact that the more emotionally involved you are in the story, the less you're going to be sort of meticulously keeping track of that. And tons and tons of things along the way. But then the reveal is really, it doesn't take any chances, right?
Right.
As we talked about before, the structure of the well-made surprise is you're given a fresh piece of information, and what it is supposed to do is not just be surprising, but sort of cast its shadow back over the earlier events of the narrative and place them in a new frame, right? Have them make fresh sense with each other and feel like, oh, now that I know this, everything makes sense.
And another great movie that you mention all the time, The Usual Suspects.
Yeah.
Is doing the same thing, and it gives you the clues at the very end about what's going on, and then you sort of write that all together.
And both of them, they say, they do not take any chances over this final moment. They give you a montage of
exactly right.
This and this and this.
They don't trust you for figuring out yourself.
Right. So they basically do, the looking back and reviewing or rereading, it gives you this capsule version of it right there in the narrative to say, these are the things that make sense now. Aren't you pleased?
You listen to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Vera Tobin, assistant professor in the Department of Cognitive Sciences at Case Western Reserve University. We're talking about her book. It's really interesting and unique. Elements of Surprise, Our Mental Limits, and the Satisfaction of Plot. I want to talk about the paradox of suspense, as you call it.
Yeah.
So suspense, really, and suspense in the absence of uncertainty. So, and this was sort of surprising to me. So suspense isn't about uncertainty?
Well, you sure would think it is, right?
Right.
It seems like it's the essence of suspense. Suspense is what you get when you don't know what's going to happen.
Right, right.
I'm keeping you in suspense by not telling you what's going to happen. But it turns out that the experience of suspense doesn't necessarily actually play out this way. So people have studied this quite a lot, and I know it from my own experience, too. It really is the case that people have experienced feelings of suspense, this sort of anxiety and dread and hoping against hope, all of these feelings about what's going to come and feelings of uncertainty and anxiety about them, even when they know perfectly well what's going to come, either because it's about something like who will be the first president of the United States, which they know, some other kind of nonfiction narrative where they have been fully warned ahead of time, or because it's something that they've already seen or read. If the structure of the narrative sets it up as suspenseful, people will feel those feelings of suspense even when they know perfectly well what's going to happen.
And this is an interesting thing, because I actually think I've read examples of this. Can a fictional character be too surprising? And if they are, what happens is, to the reader, it becomes unconvincing. So there's like this weird balancing act that the author or the film director is making, because they can be surprising, but they have to be convincing.
That's right. So as we were saying, the satisfying kinds of surprises give you a feeling of coherence, right? Like, oh, now that I think about it, it all makes sense and it all fits together and I can make a story for this in my mind where it's coherent. But there are limits to what people are willing to accept on this line of variation. And that's the sort of fail state is it doesn't feel pleasingly surprising. It feels aggravatingly inconsistent.
Or just silly after a bit.
Yeah. Right. Oh, yes. And if it's sort of one turn after another.
Right, right.
In the same narrative, you're like, okay, you know, enough. And it feels tired rather than fresh. Yes.
I want to talk about the film, The Conversation, because you have a great discussion of The Conversation in this book. It's one of my favorite films.
Me too.
Francis Ford Coppola, one of his early films. Great film. And it's interesting because it has everything to do with what we're talking about. But the main character, Harry Call, in the film is actually experiencing our surprise too, at this almost like at the same time.
Yeah, right. And I mean, one of the things that sort of as we track things over the course of the book, by the time we get to the conversation, you know, we've been looking at lots of different ways in which sort of unreliable characters, not necessarily unreliable narrators, but characters who, for some reason or another, don't have the whole picture or aren't telling the whole story, are a really useful vehicle for setting up surprises, right? They give narratives an excuse for giving you a partial picture in a way that will mislead you while still leaving open the possibility of taking it back later, right? And what happens in the conversation is it's taking this device to, you know, very nearly its complete extreme.
Right.
Where,
right.
And part of what's going on there is, you know, Call is completely confused about what's going on, and confused. He doesn't even realize that there's any possibility of confusion, right? And it's only over the course of the film that you become aware of the possibility that the information that you have is itself only filtered through this character. So your dawning realization that there's anything that could be unreliable also structurally tracks his realization that you know, he relies so much on the tools of his trade. He's a surveillance audio expert.
Right.
The possibility,
and that's not going to lie.
No, it won't lie to you.
Right, because it's a recording, so obviously it's exactly what the recording says.
Right, so as he's realizing that he has projected things onto this recording from his own interpretation and that he has misunderstood what's going on, there's this really profound floor falling out from under you for the viewer, too, of realizing that these markers of objectivity and clarity and sort of unmediated recordings with no personality between you and them have not been that, but are in fact this character's, you know, they're a projection of this character's perceptions.
And the viewer becomes unmoored at that point, because you have no idea. I mean, it's...
What is real?
Well, not only that, and we're really going to spoil this movie if nobody's seen it. But it's what's her name from Laverne and Shirley. And,
oh, I know. Now I'm terrible with proper names, even though I've
written it. Me too. Yeah. But I mean, you wouldn't expect her of any nefarious act. And
oh, yeah, that's true. Right. She's very sweet.
Right. And their conversations.
The Laverne and Shirley associations, but with them especially.
I know. And the whole conversation seems like they're worried about what's going to happen to them. And in fact, it's nefarious and horrible what happens. And it is the weird thing where the main protagonist in the film literally is in the same mental position as the viewer of the film. I mean, I didn't understand that as clearly until I read about it in your book, and I just realized that I'm the essentially where Harry Call is where I'm in the film. I don't understand anything any better than he does until he figures it out.
Right, and then you realize that, you know, these tools of surveillance and of understanding other people just aren't reliable, and there's nothing you can do about it. You know, that you can't have mastery over this situation, no matter what tools you bring to bear on it. I mean, and it's a risky film, right?
It is a very risky film. It is.
If you don't take that last step with the film, then you just feel like it's a cheat. But if you integrate it into your thematic understanding of this, you know, character portrait of Call, who's played by Gene Hackman, who really delivers an absolutely superb performance, you know, if you integrate it in that way, then it's brilliant.
Well,
part
of the thing is he sort of seems like a tabula rasa character. I mean, he's sort of a blank character. Mm-hmm. He just cares about his work. That's it. You know, you get in some details of his background as the movie proceeds. But, you know, so you sort of write yourself into the film. I mean, you become the detective trying to decode what's going on.
Decode him, right? Yeah.
And that's like Terry Garr, his girlfriend, who just ends up walking out because she can't figure out anything about him either.
Yeah, she's like, oh, forget it. You know?
Right.
And I love these little details where, you know, he's this incredible surveillance expert, and he's obsessively concerned with, you know, with basically operation security. But it turns out that apparently, although it never comes right out and you know, makes a big deal of it, he seems to be terrible at it. His landlady lets himself.
I know. It's weird.
I saw you watching.
I'm just glad we had. This is great that we're just able to talk about the film within the relationship of the book. There's so much to enjoy in this book too, and so much of it is interesting. I just love learning about different terms like the Dunning-Kruger effect, which means that even the brightest of us are prone to systematic failures of rational thought.
Yeah, well, and this is specifically about, you know, people's ability to assess their own expertise with respect to something.
Oops.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. you know, the people who aren't experts think that they're experts. People who are experts, you know, have trouble assessing how expert they really are, and so on. Yeah.
That plays a huge role in politics.
Oh, yes. I mean, it really plays a huge role in all kinds of things, in public policy and, you know, anything where humans are trying to engage in large-scale, you know, civilization-level organizations of putting people to work on things so that you don't have to do everything for yourself. It's an issue.
Now, I'm just going to leave the audience with this. You're going to have to read the entire book to see if there's a surprise ending. Or do you want to spoil that, too?
No, we'll leave it that way.
Okay. My guest tonight has been Vera Tobin, assistant professor in the Department of Cognitive Sciences at Case Western Reserve University. And we've been talking about a book. There's a lot in here, and it's really enjoyable and interesting to read. Elements of Surprise: Our Mental Limits and the Satisfactions of Plot. Vera, it's been a real pleasure.
Same here.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.